animal. Must be an animal. Come hear the animal. Talking animal. Talking animal. Good morning. This is Talking Animals on WMNF. I'm Duncan Strauss, and my guest today is Mark Emery, the narrator and one of the cinematographers on the new documentary Wild Florida, part of the Nature series on PBS. Wild Florida examines this state's unique set of environmental characteristics, including exceptional ecosystems and a striking array of animals, both native and invasive. So while the film covers animals that are practically required for a doc on Florida, like alligators and Burmese pythons, in these and other cases, Wild Florida provides information that might come as news to even native Floridians. Emery himself is a native Floridian. He's been exploring the wildlife here since he was a kid and been making films for most of his adult life. And not just here in Florida, but extensively in Alaska. And he's traveled a great deal internationally as well to make an assortment of films. I recorded this interview with him Monday because Mark is undergoing knee surgery right now, as we speak, in fact. So obviously he was unavailable to do the interview live. And we did discuss various aspects of his career, assorted filmmaking adventures and challenges in Florida and elsewhere, and a number of observations and anecdotes about filming Wild Florida, which is currently streaming on the PBS Nature website. So I'll play back my conversation with Mark Emery in just a moment here on Talking Animals on WMNF. Later in the program, I'll speak with Suzanne King, organizer of Gulfport's Get Rescued. The annual event, now in its 16th year, takes place this Saturday, February 22nd, and features animal rescue organizations with adoptable pets, vendors, artists, food activities, and more, stretching across a nice expanse of Gulfport. Right now, though, let's play back my conversation with cinematographer Mark Emery about Wild Florida, the new film, again, streaming currently on the website for PBS's program, Nature. Recorded Monday, this is Mark Emery on Talking Animals on WMNF. Thanks for joining us today on Talking Animals, Mark.
Thank you for having me.
So we'll delve into Wild Florida in a moment or two, but first, I'm interested in exploring your background to an unusual degree as wildlife filmmakers go. You seem like something of a renaissance man. You served as one of the cinematographers on Wild Florida. You're also the film's narrator. And on many other movies, you're often composing the soundtrack. So what element came first? Take me back kind of maybe to the beginning parts of your career.
Kind of an odd deal. Both my parents were classical musicians. Studied at Princeton and hang under Leonard Bernstein, New York Symphony Orchestra, that kind of thing. So I had a real strong classical. Of course, being a kid, I wanted to play outside, and so they forced Mozart on to me. Eventually, I found jazz and rock and roll, and that was okay. But initially, it was a hard dichotomy for me to go from one thing to the other, and eventually, I found a way to combine the two.
Yeah.
But as far as the wildlife end of it, I got very lucky. My dad was an Eagle Scout, and also some of the big ranches around here, the Drake Ranch particularly, at that time was 23,000 acres. So let me go on there and look at critters, and eventually I lived out there in a cabin without power for about 9 months, chasing poachers for them. Just got to be around wildlife every day. And then you learned, you know, habits and animals' repetitions and things they do before things happen. And so when I got to filming for Geographic and some of the others and PBS and BBC, what we knew then was that when you pull the trigger on a movie camera, it's $400 every 11 minutes. And if you're doing high speed, you know, way more expensive than that. So you had to know animal behavior really, really well. And that's where I was at all the time. So
yeah.
I got comfortable with lots of different animals. Done a lot on bears and salmon and a lot of underwater filming as well.
So. Yeah. So it sounds like you really grew up from the get-go in and around animals, wildlife, and just outdoors.
Yeah. Here I'm in Ocala area growing up, and Russ Allen was king. He was the crocodile hunter of the world at that point. He had every species of crocodile at Silver Springs. At that point, Silver Springs was getting a million people a year. And daily, we just did 5 or 6 shows where you milk a rattlesnake and wrestle an alligator and just interact with folks and animals and answer questions. So you learn the art of storytelling, and if you didn't, they coached you. He would tell you, you know, you need to pause here and give somebody a chance to absorb some of the things you've just said and then go on a little bit more. And so just have something they can be looking at while you're making that pause. And so it was a great place to get coached. There were good filmmakers already there at the time that were working on the PR staff. So what a place to get started on that end of it. And then later, I went to work for Jordan Klein and his son Jordy, they worked on all kinds of movies, from Splash, Cocoon, The Abyss, Jaws, just a number of different films doing underwater. And so I got my t-shirt there doing the underwater stuff with them.
So it really does cover the gamut, because while a lot of it sounds like wildlife oriented, some of those feature films where they needed underwater footage, sounds like you became the guy.
At times we did more on just selling them one-off shots and things like that on movies, most of the things I worked on were movies for Geographic, and at that time, they were all shot in movie film, and some of the other companies later on, and we did a lot with the BBC as well. And because I could wrestle an alligator, we'd take him underwater, let him go in a certain place where the light was really good, and then swim with him and catch him repeatedly. We did a piece for the Navy SEALs where we had a alligator coming in front of them, going in front of them, and the SEALs are behind him, and by working it a certain way, he faded out of the scene and the SEALs came through. So it looked like, the gator's moving out of the way for the Navy SEALs for a commercial that they were doing for the Navy.
I see. So they take on all kind of projects, I guess. Obviously, this sounds like you were in Ocala, and if I'm not mistaken, you're still in Ocala. So you basically, I don't know if there was a period where you weren't there or if you've been there pretty much your whole life.
No, we've been to about 35 countries, but we live half the year here and half the year in Alaska, roughly. Okay. Maybe more like 5 months up there.
I see.
And so we use this as a home base to travel, and then up there we'll travel all over Alaska filming. Last year I did, I think, 1,000 miles just to get to a place where they wanted me to film bears. And so it may take you a whole day to get across Alaska to go to a certain spot. So it's such a huge resource to be that close to everything and to have so many different species at your options. And underwater, it's really clear and really, yeah, just a great place to shoot. So in Florida, it's great home base. We've got manatees and alligators, and a lot of the stars that appeared in this show, are neighbors.
Right. No, that's the thing. So it's interesting that you put your time, because I mean, Florida and its environment, climate, etc., and Alaska seem like pretty much opposite ends of the spectrum to a large extent. So,
but yeah, they really are. There's the life that's shown in Alaska is really concentrated often around salmon or things like that. Whereas in Florida, if you get up in the morning, you go back in the woods, you're going to hear everything. You're going to see all kinds of stuff early, and particularly when it's dark early, and you'll see, possums, coons, and skunks, and a variety of different smaller species that just don't occur in Alaska. So we have a lot here, and then the springs are so unique here.
Yeah.
And that was a part of the film that was really fun to work on, was doing the alligators underwater and that aspect, because they're just such a cool animal underwater. But above water, unless it's mating season, it's nap time, and then they're basking and all that, but man, when they're swimming around looking and hunting and all that stuff, it's fun to watch.
Sure.
Magic underwater.
Oh yeah, well, we'll come back to a bit of that in a sec, but I'd just be curious, because it sounds like you've really covered a lot of ground, I mean literally and figuratively, in terms of your career. So before working on Wild Florida, let's say, what were maybe two or three of the most either thrilling or gratifying films you've worked on? I mean, I know there's a lot to pick from, but are there a couple that might stand out for one reason or another?
Well, there's some that we won an Emmy for, one where there was a number of cinematographers on it. It was 4 1-hours. It was called Untamed America, and so we got to shoot alligators for it, and also got to shoot brown bears on it. And we went for 2 years trying to find a brown bear on whales, on a dead whale on the beach, and we finally found it just the last few days of the shoot possibility. I was working on other things at the time, but they would call me every Saturday from D.C., and we finally found it, and there were, 25 or 30 bears feeding on this whale, and so I ended up getting about 30, maybe 30 feet away and filming it, and just the sounds and the smells and the primitive nature of it, it was just stunning. And some of the bears were probably in the, 1,000 to 1,200 pound range, about as big as they get where we are. The peninsula on the record is 1,600 pounds, so
wow.
They're kind of like a VW bug with shag carpet on them. They're just huge when they eat that much.
Wow. So I take it this was sort of a preordained part of that film, that there was a narrative element that dealt with the bears feeding on a whale, so it sounds like the film couldn't really be complete until you got that footage.
Right. And it was bizarre, because I was flying out of a little village, and it was howling, just blowing 80 or 90 miles an hour coming, and we were trying to get ahead of it, and got a ride with some guys, and they're from the villages. near Ocala. You're familiar with that. Probably there's probably 50 to 75,000 retirees there. And they said, well, what you guys been seeing? He said, well, we just saw a bear on a whale in an airplane flying to Anchorage and trying to get the altitude up so we don't get blown away. And they're showing me bear pictures on their cell phones. I said, got to get the pilot's name and number. And, yeah. So that's how we found it.
Wow.
With somebody from 30 miles from my house here in Florida.
just a weird fluke, it sounds like. Yeah.
Yes, sir.
Great. Well, this is Talking Animals on WMNF. I'm Duncan Strauss. If you just joined us, my guest is Mark Emery, the narrator and one of the cinematographers on the new documentary Wild Florida, part of the PBS series Nature. Wild Florida is currently streaming on the Nature website, and this interview was recorded Monday. So, Mark, I'm wondering, as far as being a Florida guy, lifelong Florida guy, I mean, the state is rich with stories and wildlife. It's also often, I think, misunderstood and certainly more than occasionally the butt of joke. Is there a part of you as a professional storyteller that feels like, hey, I'd like to tell you about my Florida and correct some misconceptions along the way?
Yeah, and I think we got fortunate in this one to do a little bit of that, and that's to show that it's not just the Everglades, or it's not just the Keys, or it's a combination of tropical, subtropical, and the northern part of Florida, you know, it occasionally gets snow. So, I mean, you have a real mix of habitat, and all of which are vital. They all work together in a lot of different ways. And so the other thing was that Florida was really wild at one point way back, and some of the things are starting to come back. That is, there were black bears on the beach in the 1600s and 1500s when people first started coming here, just walking up and down, picking up anything that dropped off at high tide. And there were red wolves all over the state. There was a huge migration of different flocks of birds that were coming in. And there were just, you know, a very Africa-like feel to a state that now is, you know, one of the most populated and developed. And so some of those animals, including black bears, are coming back much stronger than when we were kids. White-tailed deer are back. You've got Osceola turkeys, which are only found in Florida. It's a wild turkey that's very similar to the northern breed, but looks different, and it's just a real cool animal and very wary and hard to hunt and hard to photograph.
Yeah.
And so the notion is that all those things are gone, or that Florida is just Mickey and resorts. And the truth is, if you get on the big cattle ranches or on the state parks or in some of the big, we only have one national park, that's the Everglades, and get back off the main road, it gets wild pretty quick. And there are, of course, four different species of snakes that are poisonous, and you have a lot of other things, scorpions and different things like that. I've been had Lyme disease, it was about killed me. I had a pericardial attack on my heart, so it is still wild, and you still have to pay attention to what you're doing once you get back in there. And I think that's what people don't realize coming from other states, that exists not far off the main road. I can be five blocks from Walmart, and I can be filming alligators bellowing. So that's
for sure.
Pretty cool.
Well, speaking of that, I mean, a couple things that reminds me of. One is, can you address how decisions, given all that you just mentioned and more, how decisions were made, what to cover and who to interview, and more to the point, maybe what not to cover? I mean, the film had to have a running time, I guess, of just under an hour for the Nature PBS slot. So choices obviously have to be made always, but especially in this case, there's a finite amount of time to tell that story. So early on in like pre-production or otherwise, were there choices where you just said, well, we'd love to do this, but we just have to go another way because of time or choice?
Yeah. Well, one of the things happened was a BBC component to this, and it already aired in England before it aired here. And so Rowan was our producer, great gal, and very, very adept at research and getting everything lined up, and she did a beautiful job at that. And so we already had a number of things, and in my world, I had taken the story up to Fred Kaufman at CBS 4 years before, and the financing of the whole project was quite a bit, and so they said look for a co-producer, and of course it ended up being working with the BBC, and that was a great fit for us. And so some of the places I recommended, because I'd filmed there a bunch and I knew that in the allotted time that we could get those things that they wanted, which would be alligators mating or underwater clear water sites of anything from fish to alligators and bird nesting sites and roosts that were really good places to go. And they had on their agenda other things that I wasn't really thinking about doing, which was the northern Florida stuff with the fires. And I've been on controlled burns my whole life and never thought you know, about all the, you know, way all that worked in the north part of Florida where they're trying to bring back longleaf pine. So it was a great pit there. And then, and the key deer and the pythons I'd filmed before for Geographic and other folks. And, and they had, real interest in doing those as well. So it was a true collaboration. In most cases, I would say it was the BBC up front on that, just as the final decision, as being a major contributor to the film.
I gotcha. Yeah, well, that, you know, one of the things that's cool is that there's obviously some things that you must include that are central to cover in a film that's about Florida. So, for example, you can't do any kind of wildlife doc without devoting a hunk of time to gators. You gotta do gators, and Wild Florida certainly delivers. But some of the gator information I thought was, to me at least, a bit unfamiliar, like the low-frequency sounds that humans can't hear that they use to communicate to the other gators to attract a mate. Because I didn't know that about gators, and B, it was also interesting because it's very similar to the way elephants communicate to each other over long distances. So that was like, well, you got to do gators, and here's gators, and it's Florida, of course, but here's something that you probably didn't know about gators, even if you're a Floridian.
Yeah, and I think that's an essential part of the shows now, is because there's a lot of information out there, quick, easy stuff on the internet, and you know, in all fairness, you are still competing with that when they can go onto YouTube and look things up. And so we researched it a good bit. They have a integumentary sensory organ on their jaw, the little tiny dots, and they're called ISOs by people who don't want to make big fancy words like that.
Yeah.
But that ISO is really, really sensitive, and we've touched it literally with our hands and got our hands out on an alligator that is used to being fed at an alligator farm. And one time, if you touch it, he'll turn his head like, oh, that felt great. And you touch the other one and he snaps. He's going to take your hand off.
Oh, wow.
And so there's sensory organs completely up and down his jawline that operate like little pustules of nerve endings that are essential for him finding food underwater. You think about Florida, we got all this clear water, but in places like, and in fact, the Everglades, but also in Louisiana, that's just, you know, soup. How is he finding food? So sound and plus those sensory organs, he's picking up all kinds of vibrations on the bottom, so 60%, maybe even 70% of their young diet up until 5 and 6 feet is crayfish. How's he find a crawfish in all that muddy, soupy water?
Yeah.
So those sensory items are, if you think of his big mouth as a shovel, which is what he uses it for a lot of the time,
you're
cruising along the bottom, all those sensory organs are right on the bottom and feels and senses that those things are there, and he just makes a big lunge and grabs what he can. And so they're a lot different. Once you study them underwater and watch them underwater, I've been doing it so long, if I don't think anybody else has spent as much time underwater filming alligators as we have, because I worked on 30 films, and some days I'd be 13 to 15 days underwater with them, just day after day after day, and you've seen what they do and how they goof up and screw up too. They'll run into an underwater rock wall. They have nictitating membranes over their eyes that can't see real well.
Yeah.
They'll collide with a rock wall or a lime rock ledge, and the jowls behind them that you see on land that look kind of unusual shake like a shock absorber. So I don't, you know, I don't look fact-wise if that's the case, but it sure looks like it when they get hit like that. Takes up all the shock of running into something.
So interesting, and also it sounds like, back to the thing about the little gland or sensor or whatever, it sounds like if you happen to guess wrong, there's going to be a pretty unpleasant outcome. So
think about that every time I'm diving, because a lot of times I'm going to eelgrass filming or something like that, and a gator can be laying in there. In several cases I've come right over a 10 or a 12 footer, which underwater looks like they're 15. I mean, I understand people exaggerating alligators, because if you get up close to one that's really large, he's 550, 650, and even heavier, and underwater exaggerates by 20%. So I was parting the grass. We were chasing a couple of turtles for a shoot and handing them up to a boat, and they were taking them and using them real quick and then letting them go. And the last one, I parted the grass, and
they
had just, you know, I don't know, a foot and a half long, sitting right there, just inches away from where I'd parted the grass. So we both departed the scene rapidly, but it could have gone either way.
That's defensive.
And defensively aggressive, and I'd have been in trouble.
No kidding. Yikes. Well, also, in the same way that gators, of course, are essential, I mean, you're also, it's incumbent on you guys when you're making this kind of film about Florida to cover Burmese pythons, which are, you know, stories about those are as ubiquitous as the pythons themselves. But the film also tells some things some people may know, estimated 100,000 pythons, whatever. But one of the things, again, that I didn't No, and I might have missed a detail that puts this in greater context, but there, at one point they cited something where it was like 90%+ of mammals in the Everglades have been consumed by pythons. Now, I may, again, miss the detail that provides the context, but like 90% or 90%+ actually of mammals, over what period?
Yeah, it's staggering. It really is.
No, I was just saying, so over what period of time is that 90%, 90%+ figure apply? I mean, how do they measure that? Over what period of time did they measure that? Because that's a huge, like you said, staggering.
That's good on question-wise, but on the reality of it, just to give you an example of how decimated it's been, I can't speak to the other part because I'm not a scientist working on that project or anything like that, the Miccosukees down there have a right next to the Everglades. There's a couple of guys, Johnny and Alex Tigertail, have an airboat service. Now their families have owned 60,000 contiguous acres for a long, long time, and they didn't sell out when the Seminoles did. So they have a huge area there that they operate in. And so I asked them the same question, going, "How do you know? I mean, that seems unrealistic." And he said, "Mark, when I was a kid, my dad would take me out by the garbage can outside. It was a sandy area. And he said, we're going to count tracks." And we looked at all the different tracks and learned the difference between a possum and a raccoon. He said, "Now when I go out there, there's a track of a wide snake."
Wow. And that's it? You mean that's the only track? Is that the point?
That's the only track. And he'll say, if when there is one, that's what it is. And he said, "How else can you, figure this out?" He said, "Well, just drive back to your hotel and you're in Miami, right?" I said, "Yes, sir." And he said, "Just drive back there and on your way, count the roadkills. And then in the next three nights, so we're filming with you, just keep count of how many things you see dead on the side of the road." Well, I mean, historically, I went down there as a kid in the 60s and the 70s, my family, and there was, just stuff all over the place just because there were a lot of animals there.
Sure.
And I didn't see a single one in 3 days. And that was shocking. I mean, even up here in Ocala National Forest, places like that, you're going to see a coon or you see something possum down or something like that. But in 3 days of going back and forth, roughly 60 miles, travel 30 each way for that's six trips in 3 days, I didn't see a single mammal on the side of the road. So it's amazing because you don't see them when you're driving around the Everglades. All they're doing is tilting their head up and having just part of their nostrils sticking out. So when you look out on a big area, you say, "Oh, so I don't see any pythons." And we went through there at night doing a show for PBS Live, and I was expecting maybe I'd see one then. Never saw one. I said, "Are we in the wrong area?" He said, "Well, there are areas that have more, but they're here too."
Wow. Well, that's the thing. I mean, at one point, too, part of the film, that you guys speak with experts or conservationists, et cetera. So in the python section, we meet a licensed python hunter named Donna. While their numbers give us a sense of what she and her colleagues are up against, I mean, another staggering number really is that the female pythons can lay 100 eggs a year. You just think, oh, my God. I mean, how are you ever going to really reduce this population when you're facing those kind of numbers?
And where do you live?
Where do I live?
You in Jupiter?
Yeah, South Florida, Jupiter, yeah.
Right, so there's nothing to stop them from moving up the state. I mean, that's the big concern right now. How do we stop it, the movement out of the park? I mean, they're not just in the park.
Yeah.
They've been spotted going down down on the islands in the Keys. They put cameras on some of the bridges and see them crawling at night down the bridges.
Sure.
So you've got key deer down there. They have eaten deer. A 15-foot or 18-foot python can eat a deer. So a little key deer will not be a problem, or certainly a fawn wouldn't be a problem. So there's a lot of implications for this thing. And the scary thing is that you take Guam or some of these other countries that have had invasive snakes. There's a brown snake in Guam that's very poisonous, and it's just taken over the island. They're just everywhere, and they've had a terrific time trying to get rid of them. And you won't ever get rid of them, but you can diminish them a good bit, but very, very difficult.
And that's the thing. I mean, one of the things we learn over the course of the film, and sort of a by-the-numbers element, is that some of these things that we've already cited and some others too, for example, I knew that the state had a lot of invasive species. I guess I hadn't realized there were 500 or some odd invasive species.
Yeah. A lot of them are fish.
Yeah, okay.
And some of them are really damaging fish that we're getting up here now. One is an armored catfish. It'll drill into the side of the shoreline, and what used to be an alligator den underwater, what I would come up on, alligators will build their den up underneath a rooted system of a tree. So it's pretty substantial, and it stays there and might be many, many years and won't affect the tree so much. These guys are just drilling like 20 holes in a row on a shoreline, and trees will, can collapse because the root system's been affected or whatnot. It's just a 6 to 8 pound fish, but man, he's good. He's digging holes all over. So at low water, say on Rodman or some of those areas up here, you'll see a whole row of holes that those catfish have produced, and it's going to affect the shoreline down the road. If you're talking about 50 to 20 years, your kids and grandkids, it's going to be a different world.
Yeah, no, for sure.
One species, there's a bunch of others.
Right, no, that's the thing, and just in the water, like you say, there's so many invasive species, much less the ones that are more.
Yeah, yeah.
So again, this is Talking Animals.
Oh, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, this is Talking Animals on WMNF. I'm Duncan Strauss. I'm speaking with Mark Emery, the narrator and one of the cinematographers of the new documentary Wild Florida, part of the PBS series Nature. And Wild Florida is currently streaming on the Nature website. This interview was recorded Monday. So sorry, go ahead, Mark.
Oh, no, just saying that down where you are, it's even, you know, the canals and all around Miami have a number of different species. Cichlids, which are an African species, and some of them are Nile perch, and some of the other names for are common tilapia for them. But there's some of those species that are mouth breeders. So literally, they'll take their young into their mouth, and hundreds of them at a time, or 30 to 50 or whatever, and hold them, depending on the species. And that's a real difficult, it's a really positive way for them to reproduce. Those young are going to survive much, much better than if they were running around in the shallows and all the birds are pecking away and getting the little fry and the young fish. If they're holding them like that every time danger comes, they're much more effective and so they're much harder to get rid of in a grand scale of things.
Yeah.
They're going to reproduce really fast and be very effective.
And I'm blanking right now. What's that other fish that's super invasive and just really taken over, not just Florida, but other areas too that I forget?
Well, there's a couple of them that are well-known up north called the snakehead, and that's the one that's kind of scary because it's got big teeth and all that sort of thing. Is that the one you're thinking of?
There's that, but there's something else too that I can picture the fish. I just can't think of the name
There's also a silver carp that hits people when they're driving their boats through the areas where they are, and there might be 15 to 20 in the air. A friend of mine shot super slow-mo of them, and it's just amazing, these 6 to 8 pound fish just bouncing out of the water all of
Is it lionfish? Does that ring a bell? The lionfish? Is that the one I'm thinking of?
Oh, the lionfish is saltwater fish. Yeah, I'm thinking more freshwater. But
oh,
yes,
okay.
Absolutely. Lionfish is a big deal.
Yeah.
And they're all over the place. They're in Belize. They're in Florida. They're in a number of places. There's the thing was, they were a fish that wasn't in that environment, so there wasn't a natural predator for them.
Right.
So we need to train our sharks to eat lionfish if we can.
Yeah, to send them to school, so to speak. But so Mark, I originally had in mind to, just because there were some things, facts and figures that, like I say, have kind of surprised me, even though some of the topics are fairly common and, again, essential for a film on Florida wildlife and the ecosystem, et cetera. But since you're a lifelong Florida guy, this may not make as much sense, but I would still be curious to see if along the way there was anything that you encountered or as part of the pre-production or actual shooting that surprised you along the way of making the film.
Absolutely. There always is something, and some of it's the behavior and some of it's just species. I've never seen those aggregations of swallowtail kites. I thought that was amazing.
Oh, yeah.
That many of them. And that was stunning to me. I also was filming some of the manatee stuff when we were doing the alligator shoot. And there was a manatee. It was like a Labrador retriever. He would wait for the boat, and this was on the Silver River, so we had to get special permits to film and all that. And he would wait for the boat when I'd jump in. He'd swim off about 20 yards fast and turn around and wait. come on, let's go. And so this went on for 3 or 4 days when we were filming. He would just find the boat whenever it slowed down. He'd come right to us and hang out with us. And then when you got underwater, I mean, if you'd had a ball you could throw it to him, I imagine he'd grab it and bring it back to
you. Wow.
His sweetheart.
Do you think he was already acclimated to humans before you guys got there? Or
was allowed to swim there. Yeah. So I don't know. Tons of options for him to move up and down the river in a lot of different places, but
sure.
He kind of wanted a buddy, so that's the way it went. So guess that would be speculation. I don't know, but
right.
It was fun. That was a fun part of it. The other thing was the little baby alligators, I thought were fascinating, and we've done stuff with them before. But a lot of their behavior around their mom and things like that was interesting in real life. You know, you see the grunting going on, little babies calling back and forth to mom and getting close to her. And
for sure.
You know, you don't think of a reptile as being anywhere near that protective and such. And in the real world, we used to have to rob nests every once in a while for the Fish and Game Department. They get busy and they'd have us say, well, they got one at a, in a parking lot somewhere out near where I was working at Silver Springs, and then we would take the eggs. And so while you're doing that, the whole time the mom would attack. And so your best buddy would be out in front of you with a broom and just kind of push her away every time she came in, but wow. Over and over and over again. So for your viewers and listeners, and if you see these young ones, we were in boats filming them from a boat, or we were filming them in a way we were safe to do that, but mothers will protect those babies. So
I'm sure.
You don't want to go out and just pick one up and start playing with it because they're cute, because you can get in real trouble real
yeah.
quick.
Mom really does fat. Not like that. Yeah. So
No, she's a good mom.
Yeah, no doubt. Sure. So a couple other things, Mark. We're sort of nearing the end of our time, but a few more questions just or things that again struck me by numbers or information, like in a passage about Highway 41, struck by the reference to the road intersecting the vast wetland, and then the disappearance, I think they said, of 90% of the area's wading birds. And I thought,
yeah,
wow, this
that can both be tied into water not being available at certain times for birds to get food, and also can be tied into our new resident population of snakes. If you think about it, some of the snakes are very good at being arboreal, going up in the trees, and so there's, you know, nesting birds are really vulnerable, just the birds, the babies, everything, and some of those have been Everglade rat snake, and a number of those snakes are bird egg eaters, and that's not it's somewhat adapted to those numbers and whatnot, but now with low water and at certain times when it's vital to be able to find food and have, you know, a lot of their food is small minnows and smaller bait fish and things like that. And so when that disappears, that's big trouble, and I just go somewhere else or not make it. And,
yeah.
That's part of it, yeah.
Boy, but again, that's a dramatic figure for sure to sort of take in.
It is. When we were kids down there and riding around, it was just staggering, the amount of birds, and that's just in the 60s. So, you know, you're 40 years and 50 years, it's gone a long ways the other way. Yeah. And I don't think it's been poaching or anything like that. I think it's mostly the water problems of you know, pushing that. The water used to be a continuous slow flow, and they still call it a river of grass, but it's not quite as much flow as it used to be. And then
right.
You have a road going all the way across it, and you have pumping and all kinds of stuff going on with water going into Miami and whatnot. So
yeah,
it's a complicated thing. You know?
Tough deal, for sure. And you made a reference at one point, kind of a passing reference to gee-deer, and, you know, they typically only get a fraction of the attention of a gator or a manatee. I think they might need a publicist.
Yeah.
But it's a pretty interesting animal, and obviously unique to the Keys, and I think people are really struck by them when they hear about them, but they aren't typically covered with the commonly as some of the other animals that
yeah, and there really was a story there, and I think most people will get it. What happened was when the hurricanes came through, it took the pools of water that they normally could drink out of, which they can drink with a little bit of salinity, maybe more than you and I'd be comfortable with,
yeah.
And be okay, but when the storms hit and flooded those pools of fresh water, as that dried down, they became ultra saline, and they were super difficult, just couldn't drink the water.
Yeah.
So people, residents all in there, that one thing where we put the camera at the bottom of one of those white pickle bucket was real. I mean, the people were actually feeding and getting, not feeding so much, but just getting them all fresh water by putting water out all around their houses. So the deer got very, very used to us and used to the people that were doing this. And a great kindness showed to them. A lot of people, I know people that during the hurricane opened up their house and let the gee-deer go through the house while the hurricane was going on. So it wouldn't get blown away.
Yeah.
And the gee-deer came into the house, literally. And you saw a couple of them walking through the houses and shot. And that was not staged. That was the real deal.
So interesting. And speaking of something you also mentioned that I thought was just great footage was the kites. And just the fact that they make a 5,000-mile journey to South America, but just watching mm-hmm. them in flight and whatever, it was super, just majestic.
They're
and
absolutely
wonderful.
A stunning
yeah.
bird. And,
yeah.
And in some instances, I've seen them in the wild grab a snake and literally never stop on the ground, you know, like a hawk would do and pin it or anything. He'll grab it, it'll wrap around his hand, and he'll fly, he or she, and eat it while they're flying.
Wow.
And they're just that aerial. They mate in the air. They do everything in the air. So I was in Alaska when they filmed that conflagration of my... I had filmed some other shots of them, but I've never been able to get... I'm up there when all that happens, and they
yeah.
all get ready to go down to South America. And so it was wonderful for me to see, too. It's good that they're in that good shape. A lot of the things are coming back. There's a a general depression on some of the films of some of the companies kind of beat things down. And literally for younger viewers, it's not over. They have the more white-tailed deer than when the Pilgrims were here. Our wild turkeys are back. The numbers of deer are, like I say, are staggering. Manatees got a count of 8,000 when I was a kid. They were down to just 1,000 or two for the whole state. Wow. And so a lot of things are doing better than average, and there's so much effort to make that happen that needs to be supported and could be better, but it's not done. I mean, there's still a lot of wonderful places to go and see lots of wildlife in the course of a day here in Florida.
For sure. And speaking of things that are kind of rallying, or at least people are trying to help them rally, can you talk a little bit about the Coral Restoration Foundation and the work it does? I was fascinated by that process of growing corals in like a so-called nursery setting, I guess. And then
absolutely.
What
those
there?
Guys are great. Yeah. I just went down and did was in on the first discussions on it before we actually filmed, and they filmed that in the summer. A good friend of ours, Tom Fitz, who's a remarkable underwater cinematographer and friend, shot that, I'm assuming. But the people who were involved in making it all, we did have a long discussion with them, and they're just growing it so much faster than it would normally happen in the wild. And also, by getting a kickstart and bringing it in at one size, they bypassed all the things that might happen to them early in their life as just trying to attach to a rock, as you saw, or a piece of old coral that's dead, or whatever, how they're attaching. These guys give them the absolute best chance of getting it started. So it's kind of like those big reefs or the old barrier islands off of Louisiana. You don't think about it, but those coral reefs, if they're in good shape and if they're tall when hurricanes come, break a lot of waves up. They really do.
Yeah.
And so it'll stack a wave in a way that doesn't harm the shoreline near as much as if you don't have them there. Without them there, and it's just sand and you and the shoreline, some of those little islands are going to look a whole bunch different after a couple of storms.
Wow, great. Well, I think we have just about reached the end of our time. We've been speaking with Mark Emery, and we're talking primarily about the film Wild Florida documentary, currently streaming on the Nature website, pbs.org/nature, and his own website for filmmaking and other things is Mark Emery, E-M-E-R-Y, films.com. So, Mark, thank you so much for joining us today on Talking Animals and talking to us a little bit about Wild Florida.
Hey, it's a pleasure, Duncan, and thank you so much for giving us a chance to talk about it.
You bet. Take care. Thanks. All right, my thanks again to Mark Emery. As you probably got a sense there, really, within less than an hour, they cram a lot of great stuff into the documentary, both, again, things you would expect that would sort of be required, again, for a Florida-oriented wildlife documentary. But even then, some of the information that's provided is unexpected, and then they present some other things that might not have seen before, and just some really gorgeous footage that Mark and others have shot. So, again, that's on the PBS Nature website for at least another 2-3 weeks, I believe.